In the 2002 SDCF symposium panel entitled Magic to Do, the Director-Writer Relationship, Clifford Lee Johnson III sat down with Gabriel Barr, Susan Birkenhead, Brian Crawley, Greg Kotis, Andrew Lippa, Robert Longbottom, Susan H. Shulman, Scott Schwartz, and Janine Tesori to explore the creative processes involved in creating a new musical. The following program is a recording of the panel that took place. Hello, I'm SDC Director Daniel Sullivan, and you are listening to Masters of the Stage. This program is produced by the Stage Directors and Choreographers Foundation. The SDCF has released these archives in an effort to further education regarding the crafts of direction and choreography. Because this program was not initially recorded for the purpose of broadcast, it is not of the highest technical quality. Portions of the conversation may have been edited to improve the overall quality of the broadcast.
Well, the first thing I'm going to do is ask Susan about the first thing I'm going to do. Susan, I'd like to do, and Brian and Janine. Talk a little bit about Violet, which three of you worked on, which was used at Playwrights and Writers. So I'm just going to turn it over to you.
Actually, I think we should start with Janine. Well, her idea. I know. And actually, her idea. And Janine, why don't you do the genesis of it? And,
Violet, what started, I think, like anything else, it was completely haphazard, completely random way. I wasn't looking to do anything. I was a music director, and I saw this film on Showtime. It was one of those, I don't know if Showtime does it now, but it's now just before cabling it. They used to do these short films, and it was actually a thesis done by a woman named, I think it was Sheila Goldstein. She did something based on the ugliest book of Doris Betts. And that was a short story that Doris had written out a while ago. It's a very famous short story. And I saw this film, and I thought it was extraordinary, but then I didn't remember anything about it. And I think sometimes projects are like that. You put it away, and then it beckons from wherever it holds you. I was doing, I found out about the rights issue. Everybody knows rights are such an incredible pain in the ass to do. Just, you know, original work is always preferred and always harder. But I searched out the rights. I was conducting Tommy and quite miserable, even though the show was fantastic. I was just kind of stuck, and I think that also happens in projects a lot. So I sought out the rights, and we finally got that. Brian and I had met at BMI. I finally just flew down to see the author, Doris Betts, North Carolina. I literally just said, you know, I've had it. I just wanted to talk to her directly, and she showed up at this meeting completely clad in purple. I mean, purple. Very Southern, very still Magnolia, a fantastic, formidable woman. And I said, look, I really want a chance to musicalize your piece. And like I think a lot of authors, they're very scared of musicals. They think often that the authors want to, you know, mock them or make them very, very, not trite, but it's a scary thing to have written a piece of fiction and then have some northerner come down and ask to get the rights for it. Because I was a completely flat and black, so we looked like a group. But she was great about it, and she really gave us a chance and got the rights. I quit my job as conductor, as associate, and Brian and I literally started with Susan right away. We just, as soon as we really got the clearance, we sat down with Susan and started to do a spine. What I, you know, sometimes you just put kind of a spinal column literally together. It's like, you know, it's going to change so many times, but let's just start somewhere. And that's really the genesis of it.
Right. The amazing thing was for me was when they came to me with this idea, and I read the short story, and I said, Janine, Brian, it takes place on a bus. The whole thing takes place on a bus. And they both looked at me and went, yeah, we know, that's your problem. But I was amazed, I think, and so moved initially by the first couple of songs that they wrote together, and that's what really inspired me. I mean, I thought it was a wonderful short story, but initially I really was having a hard time seeing it on the stage, for many reasons, not just because it took place on a bus, but because it had very internal storytelling, and it wasn't a very plotted piece. It was a piece really about character and character discovery. So it was really the first three songs, I think, that started to give me a vision, a theatrical vision for the piece. And and then we took off from there, right?
Well, I was talking about how the director-writer relationship was generated. You know, if you're learning how to play tennis, you want to play with somebody who's better than you. Because you get a more challenging game and it's more fun. Well, Susan, of course, was much further along in her career than I was, you know, and further along than Janine, but not the same disparity, because I was pretty much an unknown quantity. Janine and Susan had worked together before on Secret Garden. Janine was part of the musical staff there. So Janine said right away, like, we need to get a director. I'm thinking of Susan because I think it'll keep us focused, it'll keep us writing towards deadlines, and we'll have a better chance of getting this done in 2 years than instead of 5 or 10, you know, with endless development hassles. And I thought, sure, that's great, let's try. And it was funny, like the first few meetings, I felt a little bit like I was on probation. I had to prove myself because I was unknown. But there was that bus issue. I remember I said something, and this I think might have been after we wrote a couple of songs. I said, you know, it's like a life drawing class, and you wander around the room, and everybody's perspective on the same image is different. So it doesn't have to be the same, you know, rill of a bus that's facing you every time you come back to it. And Susan's eyes lit up a little, and I thought, okay, I'm in.
Well, I have to ask, so you had a meeting, and how many meetings did you have before you actually started to write, and what did you write first, songs, or did you discuss plots, style, or?
Once we all said, yeah, let's do it, which was pretty quick, I think, we started to, there were three songs up front.
We wrote that lullaby. It was the only song that survived.
The lullaby. Right.
And I remember Susan said, the story itself is filled with flashbacks. So, you know, we meet at Susan's old apartment, and she said, let's put the story together in a linear way, in chronological order, because the story itself is non-linear, and let's just start from there. And we were just kind of swimming because, you know, the bus was, like anything, we haven't figured out really the central metaphor, any of that stuff. I mean, I think that at one time, Brian and I were thinking, oh, the bus spins, and then the top flies off, and it goes this, and then the turntable, and, you know, there are people pushing buttons. But because it got, in fact, as it got focused, it got simpler in its ideas, and that's because I think the three of us just constantly were asking the questions of, you know, what is the story that we're telling, and what central theme, and just line it up, and then the songs followed from there.
I remember doing three things at once. I'm not sure what order everything happened, because there was I think Janine and I both gravitated to our favorite moments. Janine wrote music first for Lay Down Your Head, which is a moment when Violet falls, a soldier falls asleep on Violet's shoulder. And I wrote a lyric for the moment that I really liked, where this woman was leaving her town and calling the people that live there stupid. And that sort of interested me. So that was like an early song. And I don't think when we first met that even had music. We just read the lyric, we played that song, and we spent the rest of that meeting, I think, just said, okay, well, let's list the beats in this story and what interests us and what do we want to musicalize. And after we do that, we can worry about, you know, what we want to follow what later. So that was all sort of at once.
Yes, and there were many, many plotting sessions because, as I said, the story itself does not have much plot, and we kept trying to go back to the story and find moments of conflict that we could illuminate, that we could take beyond the story itself. And I think we were fortunate in this case to have Doris, who basically was giving us this freedom, but I think it's just generally very important that when you adapt something for the stage, that you can stay very true to the spirit of the piece, but not slavish to the storytelling. And I think that's very important, because it's a narrative, and it's not a play, and it was written as a narrative. And I think constantly we were trying to take what was narration and what was internal thought and find theatrical ways to put that, to make that, to communicate that. It also very interesting along the way and along the development. We had a very good development situation with this. We had many opportunities. We were at the O'Neill. We were at Playwrights. We were at Lincoln Center. So we had workshops and we had readings, and all the time major things changed for us. I think one of the joys in this collaboration was that nobody was very much afraid, or certainly learned not to be afraid, of taking whole things and just throwing them away. And going, you know what, this just doesn't work. It's nice, but it just doesn't work. And it was very difficult, especially for Act Two, to structure it, because the original source material was not helpful to us there. So there was a lot of invention involved. And it's a little side tale. I think it's an interesting thing about writing a musical. It's all about rewrites. And you've heard this a million times, but it is the truth. You're constantly reworking the piece. And on opening night at Clarence Horizons, Janina Bryan gave me a booklet this big called What Were We Thinking? And it was all the outtakes. All the songs that never made it to the final, you know, all the scenes that and you went through and you read them in retrospect and you go. But I think it's important that it was done. I mean, if we didn't have that, we never would have had the final product, and that's the point. The point is to explore all the ideas and take them to their fullest, no matter how ridiculous they appear later on, because they often give you the clue to something else. And I think that was the greatest part of the relationship, to encourage each other to do that.
I think that you'll find that every single one of these teams of writers has, if they don't actually have a booklet like that, they have in their mind a drawer somewhere with songs and ideas that never actually made it. As each of these artists describes how he or she worked on their particular show, each one will be different. There will be common themes, I'm sure, but not only will each person's experience be different, I think each time one of them works on another project, it won't be quite the same, because each show will dictate its own evolution. And I think that's fun. And so we're going to turn to the next person, Robert Longbottom. Surprise. He was the director of many, many shows, but I think we're going to talk about Sideshow first. But I think the first reading of Sideshow happened at Manhattan Theater Club when it was called Songs of the Siamese Twins.
Oh.
One for me. There you go. And so the first thing he did was change the title, I'm sure.
Yes, he did.
Exactly. And so if you just want to go from there, were you on from the very beginning, or did they approach you with...
No, I approached them. I saw this terrible movie when I was still in a road company at 42nd Street called Chain for Life. It depicted these two ladies in a very unfortunate way that was kitschy and fun in a John Waters kind of thing, but there was something about that condition that they shared and the honesty in which they lived that stayed with me. And I showed it to my friend Bill Russell, who had collaborated with me on a crazy off-Broadway thing called Pageant. And I said, does this speak to you? Do you think I'm crazy? And after a while, he said, no, I think it really is an interesting metaphor for what it means to have duality in all of us, and to share a life with someone else, and what a great thing to think about as a Broadway musical. So we approached a composer who we both adored, Henry Krieger, who'd written Dreamgirls, and shared this crazy idea with him, and he also loved it. We had no idea where to start, how to begin this. It was never going to be a plot-driven evening. It was more a number of examinations of what it meant to share intimacy, sexual intimacy, an onstage career of all things. Because these girls actually did sing and dance. They were a huge sensation in vaudeville in the 20s, made a couple of movies, namely Todd Browning's Freaks, and
I was home. I loved it. I mean, I said, this is speaks of my childhood. These girls, their condition, the fact that they learned to tap dance, sharing very compromised situation. So we came up with a title for the opening number called Come Look at the Freaks. And once they identified that, and I had an idea of how to actually put these two girls on stage together in a believable way, that opened the door. But the journey was very long. It was about 6 years, a terrible title that Manhattan Theatre Club had no interest in pursuing, which we didn't blame them at the time, but we learned a great deal from it. Characters were removed, other people were created to help tell the story. We were really lucky to do a workshop for 6 weeks on the stage of the Richard Rogers Theatre, where our producer was able to get space for us, and the crew left us alone, and at the end of those 6 weeks, we basically put on a show. Robin Wagner designed 4 sets of movable bleachers, which, depending on how I moved them around the stage, kind of took you to backstage, onstage dressing rooms, and so forth. We sort of didn't want the process to end because we had become such a loving family, the three of us, and was joined by David Chase, who was our musical supervisor, dance arrangements, and vocals, and all of those things. So,
did I understand right that the idea originated with you? Is that what you were saying?
I didn't have the idea for these two girls' life, but I started to do a musical about Daisy and Violet Hilton and see where we might go with that. Would anybody else like it, and would it, you know, resonate? And is it a reasonable metaphor?
Right.
So it was my idea.
And so there was. So you had that much of the idea, and then you turned it over to the writers, and at that point they went off and produced a draft, and you started the rewriting process after that.
Right. Henry and Bill would work on, you know, a scene, and then they would show it to me, and I would have comments, and they would have comments, and they'd either go back and rewrite some things, or we would agree it's terrific and move on to the next thing. But I was certainly not in the room with them when they wrote this, gave them their space to create it. It was important for me to see the scene, to see the number, to see the dance. And if there were things they wrote that I said, I have a really hard time imagining that on stage, can you help me with this? We would go back and revisit it. So it was that kind of collaboration.
Susan, I'm going to skip over to Gabe and Andrew because I have a master plan. I'll come back to you in just a minute, okay? Nothing personal. For those of you who don't know, I worked with Andrew Lippa and Gabe Barry on the Manhattan Theater Club version of The Wild Party. But I'm not going to add much to that conversation. I'm going to let you guys talk about it. Andrew, how did the idea for The Wild Party come about, and at what point did Gabe come on?
In the end of 1995, I was looking for something to do to follow up a small show that I had done that Gabe also directed at the Lamps Theater called John and Jen. And I was looking for something to do, and I went to a bookstore and was browsing through poetry sections, because at the time I didn't have a lyricist I wanted to work with had an idea that, you know, for anything. And I had never written lyrics before, and so I thought, well, I'll just write like a song cycle or, you know, something like that, or make, you know, cats. And I was browsing through the poetry section, and there was this really cool spine, and I opened up this book with these really cool pictures called The Wild Party, and it had a fuzzy red, like, inside part of the book. It was like half a bunny, and it was so cool. You know, fuzzy red was me, it said me. And I read the poem in the store, and it was like my jaw sort of dropped to the floor, and I was convinced that I had to write this show. And I've never had that experience before or since, and I hope to get it again one day in my life. That absolute out-of-the-blue sort of bolt of lightning that says, you know, drop everything and do this. And I didn't have much of an everything to drop at the time. we sought out the right situation, and at the beginning of 1996, I started to write the show, and then I came to Lee, who had offered his assistance in the past and said if I had any show I would like to talk about, I should come to Manhattan Theater Club. And I did, and played a song or two for Lee, and Lee was like, write it and we'll do a reading. And at the time it was so thrilling. I was like, I didn't even write anything, and I was going to get a reading for it. And so I kept writing. I got the first act done in August of that year, and Gabe saw it. But at the time I was so driven by the piece itself and so naive, because I was just writing the book, the music and the lyrics all by myself, and nobody, it felt like I was supposed to do it, you know, and I didn't feel like I wanted to work with anybody at that time. So I kept going, and then Gabe came to me later the next year and said that he had the opportunity to bring a piece to the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center and did the I Want to Work on the Wild Party together. And I was like, eureka, and it was suddenly like, why didn't I think of that? And we started working on the piece, and that's really sort of how it all sort of came together, working together.
At that point, did you just have the first act, or did you have a whole draft finished when you went up to the O'Neill, and did you finish it at the O'Neill?
I had a whole draft of a piece, much like Janine and Brian's book, What Were They Thinking? I wrote like five songs while I was at the O'Neill, and we chopped a lot of material, and all of that was working with Gabe, talking about, I remember when we first got there, the first night, you know, you get there on Sunday, and Sunday night we sat down talking, and Gabe and I had already worked together before, so we had a very close relationship in how we would work together. And he said, you know, I had a song that was where the title song was, and it wasn't a very good song. And so he said, well, what if it were rock? You know, like every time we work with a director may just say something that isn't necessarily the idea, but they sort of make it go like that, you know, and then you go, oh, you know, and then you go into a hole and write it and come back and show them what you did. And it's kind of like looking in the mirror, like, do I look fat? You know, it's like, you show them what it is, and they say, oh, yeah, let's do this now. You know, and so it's really like a traffic cop sometimes, and that really helps, you know, among many other things that directors do.
Is that what happened, Gabe, or was it
the... it was a tremendously rewarding process working with Andrew, as I found it, with many and most writers, all writers really, I've had a chance to work with. And the interesting thing that Manhattan Theater Club itself provided us, beyond the O'Neill Theater Center, we went back to Manhattan Theater Club, did a reading, two readings, I think, and then a full workshop. And it sort of became clear to us that there were two ways to approach this material. It's difficult source material because it wasn't written with forming the material in mind. Certainly, it was an epic poem written in 1927, and we decided at first, based on the experience at the O'Neill, as we neared a workshop at the Manhattan Theater Club, to take an approach, for instance, with the show that would essentially make it a cautionary tale, where you weren't really concerned about whether the audience enlisted in these characters. Or sort of got behind them emotionally. We intentionally wanted to make Queenie, our lead character, basically go down in flames. And when we did the workshop, in fact, we together committed to that. And it was one of the examples of how a workshop and various readings can be extremely informative when you start to see things and also get reactions from people who are seeing it for the first time.
We did a big kick line number at the end of the show where the leading lady got electrocuted. And that was the idea.
And a
really good idea.
And the two people she had killed moments earlier came out of the body bag.
But they did sing.
They did sing. In the window. But then we had the stupidity or the naivete or the inexperience to go there, and the Manhattan Theater Club provided us, shut their eyes, and provided us that opportunity. It was fantastic. And it wasn't long after that workshop that we sat in a room together and said, okay, we tried that. How would we make this work taking almost the opposite approach, and to try to make Queenie, this lead character, sympathetic? And at that point, we, once making that decision, of course it affects absolutely every moment of the show underneath that choice. And so we dissected the show again, sifted through material. Some was able to stay in new context,
and Andrew got out his pen again and started working away. And as we worked towards a full production, we shifted the entire sort of slant on the show. So it was an interesting process that, even though I came in sort of after there was a first draft, we still took very vast different approaches to that material that then in turn demanded vast rewrites. And it was a great, great learning experience, but also wonderful, wonderful adventure.
I want to open this discussion up just a little bit more now, because most of these writers are currently working on new musicals, even as we speak. And I want to bring Susan and Scott in. They're not working together, but I know you're both working on new projects. Scott, you're working on a musical called Kept right now. And that's Henry Krieger
and Bill Russell.
And Bill Russell. And Susan, you're working on Moonstruck. And is that Henry as well?
Henry and John
Patrick Shanley. So you're working... We've been talking about things that have happened, and these are happening at the moment. So, Susan, how does it work? Do you guys meet periodically or every day?
This is the first.
And who's directing?
This is the first time ever that I did a musical that basically is being written first.
Mm-hmm.
And then the director is going to be brought into it. This was a choice of John Patrick Shanley, who wrote the movie of Moonstruck, created that world, created those characters, and jealously guarded those rights for years and years and years and years, because he was afraid that someone would do violence to that little world that he had created. And it took an enormous amount of gentle stroking on the part of the producers to get him to agree to have it musicalized in the first place. He would flirt with the idea and say, yeah, I think this mm-hmm. is great. I think these are the people to do it. And then he would say, but only if I write the book. In the beginning, it was only if I write the book, the music, and the lyrics. And he's not a composer, and he's out. And he had never written a musical.
So in a way, for this discussion, it would be maybe more appropriate to talk. We could talk about Jelly's Last Jam, or The Night They Raided Minsky's, in which Mike Lockhart was working with you on that for a while. Is that right? And you said earlier that you would sit in the room with him and.
Well, both of those shows actually were collaborations from the very beginning. I was the last one brought in to both of those shows. Jelly's Last Jam was George Wolfe, who wrote the book as well and directed it. When we first began, George was not the director of choice. George had never really, in fact, directed anything. But I had written a show with George that ran afoul of the whole Bright situation and had fallen apart. And he brought me into Jelly's Last Jam. And I think the first day that I met George and spoke to him at any length, I said, this man is a director. He's a director. He just has a director's mind. And eventually, we were able to convince the producers that he should direct it. But in Jelly, as well as in The Night They Raided Minsky's, where I was the last person brought in, and Mike Operand, who died 3 years ago, and Susan Stroman, who was his wife, and Charles Strauss and Evan Hunter and I worked almost from the beginning in the same room. So that the whole thing was really created by the five of us. Frankly, I find that the most exciting way to work of all. I think that the magic words, it was either Bobby or Susan who said, you know, this has to play. I need something that I can direct that has to play on stage. If an actor comes to me and says, I don't know how to do this line. I can't figure out a way to do it. I immediately know that line has to go and it has to be reconceived. The same is true of the scene. Anything is not going to play on a stage because that's what it's all about in the beginning. And I think one of the luxuries of working with a director is the fact that
whereas we work on a moment at a time and keep the whole movie in mind and keep the whole story and the spine of the story and all that delightful stuff, we tend to lose sight of it very quickly when you're working on, when I'm working on a lyric and I'm fiercely focused on that particular lyric and that particular moment and that particular character. It's the director who has the whole thing in mind and constantly reminds everyone of the whole evening and the whole art of the piece. It's also incredibly time-saving because if you write the whole thing and then bring it to a director, you know you're going to start all over again.
Well, that perfect segue to the next sort of phase of discussion. Musicals that are already written to some degree, at least maybe a first draft or a second or a third draft, and these two gentlemen next to me. We can talk about any of the other things, guys, that we've already started, but just to make sure we get to the question and answer period, I'm just going to rush on through the next phase. I'll just skip to you, Greg. John Rando came in to work on Urinetown when I know it had been produced down at the Fringe. Right. Tell us when he came in and then what happened when he came in.
Well, we originally produced Urinetown at the New York International Fringe Festival, which is a festival on the Lower East Side that happens in August. And we had a great run. And we had the good luck to have some producers come through and meet with us and say, we think this can have a greater life. Would you, you know, give us the rights to take it further? And we said, okay. And so bringing John Rando in, who was our director, was a really crucial step because he was a respected director. He had worked with a wonderful group of actors through his career, including Nancy Opel and others. And he was really a very important link to say, yeah, this is a crazy play. This is really sort of, beyond pale. But I can make this work, and I'll take this to the next step. And that just involved first bringing in the right actors, bringing in the right creative team when it got to that point, and being the crucial hub to this process, because Mark and I came from, off Broadway without... I didn't have any real idea of coming to the commercial world, but Mark did. And so, at least I was very suspicious and skeptical of the commercial world. And John was someone who just sort of created a lot of trust, or at least someone you could talk to be honest with. He was the crucial link, because the producers could talk to him and say, the writers are out of their minds, talk to them. And we could say to them, the integrity of the play. So I think a good director is a good diplomat also, and he was able to do that.
So when John Rando, he was essentially brought to you, is that, it's safe to say that?
Yeah, the Iraqi group was the group that saw the show at the Fringe Festival. And they said, I heard Mike Rigo was one of the producers, and I believe he has said, I read this somewhere, that Rando was the only director they knew, which is gratuitous, but really he was the perfect director to shepherd this piece because, but he was brought to us. Uh-huh. They brought him the script and said, what do you think of this? And he says, I like it and I want to do it.
So I think we were all sort of interested in what sort of discussion you had with him. I mean, did you ask him questions about the, so that you could understand whether he had got the style and I'm just wondering how that went, and how long did it take before you knew he was the right person to go forward?
I think we had a meeting, the Iraqi group. We had a meeting in the fall of 1999, I think. And the idea was we were going to have a staged reading, a commercial reading, or a backers audition, I think they're called, too. And so the Iraqi group said, okay, I think we found our director, and we met in the conference room of the producer's office,
And John came in, and, you know, we just sat down, and Mark and I didn't really say anything at all. And he just started talking about the piece, and we knew immediately that this was a guy who understood the spirit of the show. He understood the comedy of the show. I mean, he was trying to be very serious about the stuff, but kept cracking himself up by what he was saying. And, you know, that we understood that that he could sort of play that those two sides, the seriousness and the madness of the piece. So I think we knew right away, just by his energy, just by his personality, that he was right for us.
Did you feel? I'll just shout. So,
okay.
Did you feel that the show continued on in the direction that it was going, or did it veer from what it had been before?
No, I think it stayed what it was meant to be, and actually sort of expanded it. Sort of he heightened it. You know, the thing about Urinetown is that it's sort of a conspiracy of, like, you know, it feels like you're in the middle of a conspiracy to be doing it, because it felt like something that should not be done, and that's why you should do it, you know, and that was shared by that was shared not only by John but by the producers as well. I mean, these were the people who were putting their money and their reputations on the line, but they had the sort of conspirators. You know, we're going to conspire against ourselves, and so John served that, and he understood that this sort of this renegade spirit was the thing that really was going to propel the thing forward, and that was like the defining energy throughout. Like we're you know, our metaphor was like we were a little pirate ship, and we're going to sneak into the harbor and sink the fleet. And so that was that's what it felt like. That's what we wanted to do.
And did you do many rewrites once he came aboard? I assume that you did, because that's what you do in a musical, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think the show was maybe 80% done, or 70%. I don't know what the percentage is, but it was largely done. But really crucial things happened, and they came from different directions, but they also came from the director as well. Where they said, you know what, we need a number here that, you know, there's a number in the second act called Run Freedom Run, which had been our showstopper, and we were very protective of it. And John Rando and John Carafa, the choreographer, came to us and said, you know what, we really need like a hot dance number just before it. We need something for the ensemble to do. Because this is what happens in a musical, like in Kiss Me, Kate, there's, you know, Too Darn Hot. So write that. And I was skeptical of this. Mark was a little bit skeptical, but less so. But we wrote it, and they were absolutely right. It was exactly the right thing to do. And in other, you know, as the book writer, there were other moments where we would look at a scene, and John would come to me and say, you know, Greg, you know, is it possible to make this scene funny? And...
Now we're getting into the nitty-gritty.
So he, you know, he was, for me, he was a confidant. He was someone, you know, because we were, you know, we didn't know what the score was. You know, we were working with all these big people, and we were not big people. And as far as we knew, we didn't know, until it was done, we didn't know what was right and what was wrong. And John was someone I could come to and say, I don't think this is the right choice to make, and he would either confirm my suspicion or he would make me see the choice from a different angle, and that trust was really important.
But there was something interesting. One of your actors, Daniel, just did a reading for Andrew and me, and he said your musical changed less than any other musical he's ever worked on. Oh. Like, so that what came into the room, it sounds like you added a couple of songs, but what you started with, you know, was kind of, he thought the whole gist of the show was in place and kind of stayed together. That was his perspective, but it's interesting.
If that's true, that is an anomaly. Do not expect that to happen with your show. It does happen every once in a while. Scott, you came in and directed two shows last season that to some degree already existed, one being Tick, Tick, Boom, and the other Bad Boy, and both, of course, were very successful. So explain when you came in and what you had to do on both and differently on both.
Well, that's going to be a pretty long answer. I'll try to keep it short because it's two totally different shows. Let me talk about Tick, Tick, Boom for just a minute, because it's actually a very, very unusual circumstance, which, you know, I actually hope most people don't have to deal with, because the fact was our writer was dead. But the show wasn't finished. If you don't know, Jonathan Larson had been developing a one-man show called at various times Boho Days or Tick, Tick, Boom. Around the same time, he was developing Rent. But eventually, Rent took precedence, and he kind of put it aside. And a couple of producers actually came to me and said, look, we want to do this show. We think it's really wonderful. And we want to show, you know, that Jonathan did other stuff. Because a lot of people really felt, I think, that Jonathan Larson kind of wrote Rent. And that's, you know, I had even heard it said, you know, gee, if he had been around, that probably would have been the only thing he would have ever done. He would have been one of those one-hit wonders. And so I looked at it, and what I got was actually five different scripts, which were very, very different. They had a lot of the same numbers in them, and, you know, elements that were the same, but then also things that were totally different. And some videotapes, actually, of Jonathan performing it, because he had done it as a one-man show. And so I kind of said to Robin, one of my producers, I said, I think we need a book writer to come in and sort of help us shape this. And at the time, Proof had just opened, actually, at Manhattan Theater Club. And I said, not knowing sort of the genius I was suggesting, I said, who's that guy? He wrote that show. You worked on it at Manhattan Theater Club. It's like Proof, isn't it? He'd be good for this, don't you think? And he'd never done a musical before. But he was enthusiastic. And so what David and I did, and David really was a huge, I mean, I mean it when I call him a genius. He was a huge influence on the show. He came in, and we looked at these five drafts, and I said to him, you know, there are all these monologues where Jonathan kind of says, I said, and then he said, and then I said. I said, you know, it'd be really nice to let the actor actually be in the moment occasionally, rather than having to constantly be narrating their own life. And so I said, let's, you know, we need two backup singers anyway. Why don't we make it one guy and one girl instead of, you know, two women or two men? And let's make it a three-character show, and they can play, like, little parts throughout. And it turned out that they primarily played Michael and Susan, these two very important roles. But David, what happened was David and I sat down, and kind of talked at this little diner, and then David said, I want to just go away. And he kind of completely restructured the show, but stayed completely loyal to Jonathan. What's amazing is David also said, I don't want to write anything for this. All I want to do is kind of bridge gaps, but I don't want to actually add any words. You know, he ended up maybe writing 15% of the show. You can't tell, though. I mean, it all sounds like one writer. But he really restructured it. And so we took these songs and kind of moved them around because we couldn't change the songs, which is tough when you can't turn to somebody and say, I need a number that does this. We had to kind of look at Jonathan's catalog, and there were one or two songs, actually, which one song, Real Life, specifically, which had been in and out of the show, but it was used in other things, and so we would pull from different sources. And Stephen Arimus, our musical director and arranger, also was very influential in that I could turn to Stephen and say, you know, I really need a number between Susan and Jonathan. Go take this song Therapy, which was a solo, and make it into a duet. I think I actually turned to Stephen and I said, you know, make it like one of those Irving Berlin songs where they kind of sing one thing and then the other one sings and eventually they overlap. And so that's what we did. So that was basically the process on Tick, Tick, Boom. We did actually one reading at Manhattan Theater Club, of course. And then the producer said we got the James Street Theater, so we went right into rehearsals, and we did do a lot of development over the course of rehearsals. But once we got to previews, the show was pretty well set.
Right. Most of what we're talking about is the sort of the creating, the developing, the writing process. Obviously, musicals get written in the casting room to some degree, and I'm sure you're going to talk about that. They get written in the design conversations. They get written in rehearsal, and then they get written in previews. When everything works out, it's finally written at the end of that process. Bat Boy was different. It had actually been produced in California. Is that,
yes.
That's right. And so it was a produced musical, and then they came to you to work on the New York production. Is that...
Yeah, I told them the story last night about how I came to Bat Boy, so I won't bore you with that again. But so when I met with the authors of Bat Boy, it sounds like we actually had a similar experience, though on opposite sides of the table. The authors were actually, particularly the book writers, there were two book writers, were quite wary about bringing in an outsider. You know, they were from Los Angeles, and they had this company called, you know, this the Actors Game that had a very specific method. And they were very leery about bringing anyone else in. But I sat down with them, and we kind of chatted, and I think we saw the same show, and so we moved along. But they had a very clear idea of what they wanted their show to be, and that's why I think there was a similarity there, and you produced it as well. And they had produced the show in Los Angeles. So I came on board, and it then, of course, changed enormously. We did three workshops before the production where we actually staged it. We did it in a very rough way, but that ultimately became the style of the show because we liked it so much. And at the beginning, Bat Boy, for those of you who saw it, his character can't speak for the first, like, 45 minutes of the show, which is tough when your lead can't say anything because it's a little hard to sympathize with them. And actually the song Show Me a Thing or Two, which was quite late in Act One, was the first time he spoke when I came on board. And so the authors and I sat down and we kind of said, well, we really have to look at this. And, you know, an idea came up to do a song where actually another character sort of spoke for him. We added it threw things in and out of the show. The core of the show always stayed basically the same, what Bat Boy's journey was. And I have to say that was really pretty solid from the moment I came on board. We certainly changed stopping points in that journey. There were moments which needed to be fleshed out more, or frankly, less. But the authors and I will talk about that. But what really we did the most work on was kind of the whole surrounding journey and the rest of the show. What's the show actually about? I mean, I'm a big believer in the theme on musicals, and what is your musical actually about? What philosophy, what ideas are you trying to explore? And I personally believe that you want all of the stories to deal with basically the same theme. It may sound simple, but it always ends up being harder than that. And on Bat Boy, that was one of the problems. We had this central story, but we didn't really have the side stories. So we had to keep going back to, what is this actually about? And are we actually saying that? And I mean, we treated the show as if it was Oedipus, you know, for this silly little show where stuffed animals dance around the stage. You know, we really treated it as if it was the most serious story ever told. And to a certain extent, I think we all kind of believe that. So I don't know, is that answering your question?
Yeah, I think that it answers it very well. I'm not trying to cut off everyone's chance to say something, but I do want to open the floor up for questions from you guys. If there's something about some element that somebody wants to just pitch in, feel free to do that. I certainly don't mind. I guarantee you I could talk for at least 2 hours with each one of these people, at least 2 hours, about the various things that they're working on and have worked on. There's so many great shows that didn't even get mentioned today, and that's just because these guys are doing so much work. We may come back to a few depending on how many questions and what sort of things you'd like to know. So I will start that. Take my glasses off. I saw a hand over here first.
To all of you, thanks for being here. I was just curious. You mentioned the Manhattan Theater Club, you know, some workshop venues, the obvious ones in town, the Fringe Festival. Where are some regional workshop venues that you all have been exposed to that are worth mentioning? Whether it's LA or New
Well, most regional theaters have second stages or reading series where they really do develop new work.
For musicals?
Yep. Especially for a reading series or a second stage. So, I mean, I think that's certainly very worthwhile exploring.
Joey Slapjack was developed in Los Angeles at the Marte Forum.
Right.
Three workshops and a regional theater production there before it ever came to New York.
There are also a number of places, like the O'Neill is the big one that I've been to.
Right.
But there's also the New Harmony in, where's that, Indiana, which I haven't been to. And that place that you two have been to, which is that Sundance thing?
That was for an opera thing. Sundance in the summer is the thing, right?
Yeah. But there are a lot of regional theaters. I'm doing a piece of George Wolf, I'm going to be at Berkeley, uptown.
The Globe Theaters do a lot of work, and everyone.
Goodspeed. Well, there was just some flyer I got from TheaterWorks and Palo Alto that Scott, your name was on. They're doing some sort of developmental thing, right?
Well, I was just going to say, I'm actually getting on a plane later today to go to San Jose Rep for their New Works initiative to do, in fact, a new musical that we're developing. You should look for places that have sort of new works initiatives. A lot of them will do at least one musical. And the show that I'm doing right now is not by particularly famous writers. So you should look for what companies have that. A lot of them do, new work initiatives.
Well, the Prince Music Theater does practically all new music. So
Seattle, the new theaters are right now. What's happened, I think, in regional theaters is everyone... This new piece that I'm doing is by Terry Kushner. He's quite famous. George Wolf, very famous. Me, not famous. And we are really, you get squished when you preview in New York. You just do. It's a brutal time. I don't recommend it for anyone. What's happened is instead of really being able to experiment, although the public theater has been an artist in residence for this year, you really can be safe down there. As soon as you open to the press, there's really no... They perceive it, I think, as, well, you're done, right? I mean, we're just going to review you like you are finished, and it's unfair, but that's what it is. And I think more and more people, I mean, all of us have started our projects not in New York. And I think that's some of the regional theaters that come up. And every single regional theater, I know of, major and small ones, like the Apple, what was one in Chicago? Chicago's become this really great center for musicals.
The Apple Tree.
Yeah. It's a major start, last 5 years, was in Skokie, Chicago. So the great thing is, all these American theaters are becoming part of the process that once was exclusively New York, and it's now shared, which I think is better. I mean, it's hard moving your family around, but so be it. I think it's actually great.
And the Prince is with the American Music Theater Festival.
The Prince basically is the American Music Theater Festival, yes. Another question? I saw this hand back here.
My question is for the directors on the panel. Is it always more enticing for you to come on board a project near the genesis of it, or can something that's very far along the development process be just as enticing?
I think it's very individual. It depends on the piece. Really. I love the collaboration, so I'm always very inspired by being there at the beginning of a project. I just love working it's one of the main reasons I'm in musical theater, because there's so many people to collaborate with, and you're sort of not there by yourself. But, somebody plops a really great musical on my desk, I'm not going to say, oh, no, I need to be there from the start. So sometimes, though, to be quite honest, it is easier to be there from the start, because it can be difficult to initiate rewrites with something that has been totally completed. I think it sometimes is a little more difficult to convince writers and composers that perhaps this piece that they've lived with in its entirety is not finished. Even though they kind of know it, it's difficult to come in and say, but I think actually the entire second act, I love the piece, it's inspiring, but the entire second act doesn't really work. To look at those faces at that moment that you say that is really heartbreaking. it's also the ideas are great and the talent is there. I mean, you can see that, and that's very inspiring as well.
Let's start in the back. You in the back?
Yep. Yeah. My question is, as a composer, lyricist, and director, the question I've been asking all my life, every time I see a musical, if it's a musical, why is anybody talking?
Because, oh my God, that's not the howl. Because that's what they're called. That's the definition of a musical. I mean, operas, they don't, and that's why it's an opera.
That's not an answer.
Also,
there's
I mean, I'm just interested, why are you asking me the question?
I
was asked because what are you searching for?
Every time I sit in the audience,
yeah,
and the music stops and people talk, I don't know why I'm sitting there.
Well, maybe you've seen a lot of musicals with bad books.
Or maybe I haven't seen one with a good book.
Well,
I think that's an unanswerable question, actually. That goes to taste, and it's not, that's just an unanswerable thing, so.
I have a question, sort of back to what Andrew Lippa said. Does, anyone have thought about this, that does the quintessential American musical in its sort of perfect form necessarily have two acts? And how does the answer to that question affect the way you view stories as you try to bend them and shape them into two act structures that they either are or are not really fit to have? How does that affect the development process of
an idea? You know, I think you tell the story and then you decide later. I think you just go about telling the story and how you're going to tell the story and then write it. And then at some point, I think, at some point you just say, oh, well, I think the natural act break is here, or we can't have an act break. I don't think you start out saying, we're going to write a first act and this is going to... You do that in movies a lot.
Well, the reason I ask you is just I tend to think of them as having two acts, and but is that not an assumption everyone makes, that they sort of have two acts?
They usually do, but I think that you don't start out thinking this will be the first act and that will be the second act. I think you just start out telling the story.
And that changes, I mean, often where, and certainly my experience often where the act break will be, will change during the course of the development.
But Bobby, Patton didn't have two acts, did he?
No, because we wanted to keep the event, not unlike Chorus Line. You sat down and at the end of it, somebody got a job, the audition was over, the pageant was over. You really have to identify the reason to come back after an audition, what takes place time-wise during that, but it changes.
The brilliance of that show, which I remember, I don't know if you ever saw it, but Patrick was like such an incredible experience that you really, on so many levels, was subversive. It was just like, I remember it. The half-life of that show goes on and on and on. And part of that was you went on a ride, and then it ended. There wasn't that relief, you know, from this cast. There was a subversiveness even to not letting you go. And I think that was part of the design, you know, of the one or the two acts, you know. But it's an interesting...
It was an intermission, and it was talked about, well, they've got to sell drinks and all this nonsense. And I said, but we're not a musical comedy. I want this to somehow play as though it's a real happening event. So we all...
In the business, having a one-act musical is a very... I mean, this is not the topic. It's a huge thing for the concession stand, and you hear about the producers all the time.
You hear about it all the time. I will...
I mean, it's unbelievable. They have to have their Twizzlers, you know?
with the wild party the workshop wasn't one act, and it was a 2-hour 10-minute event, and our theory that we really wanted to do that, transport the audience and not let them go from this small two halves, to a certain extent that can also at the end of the experience be joined again, but we were able to do it in that case. But there are some shows, like Pageant was a great example, and some where it doesn't make sense to do that. And I'd say in the commercial world, there is a trend towards intermissionless shows now.
Certainly.
Plays, certainly. And so I think the piece, like Susan said, has to dictate it. And you follow that, and then other outside influences come in. You either can adjust to them successfully, or you can't. And
have you ever seen Chorus Line with an intermission? really horrible.
Yeah.
Horrible, really? Has he beat me back on stage in 5 minutes?
With some Twizzler.
Yeah.
The Marquis Theater is like, I finally said, why don't you give them nuts and nutcrackers? You know, the noisiest thing possible. Come and eat it.
Right here.
When I was reading the other side of the book on the TV of Spirit and Mountain, you had this experience of when you go to flight, you didn't like the flight very much, and then it evolved into your book. What was the significance?
Can you stand up and talk, please?
Correct. What were the significant moments, or what were the tools or the moments of breakthrough or enlightenment that you kind of developed for you as an emergency character, and when you finally really liked it?
Well, it was designed to be a musical, so it wasn't a play first, and then became a musical. But the biggest hurdle, and it's interesting because it relates to what you're talking about, intermission, because we wanted to write something which was sort of archetypical in its structure. We wanted to have two acts because that seems to be the tradition. I mean, that's like the depth of our tradition is you have the first act, you have an intermission, you have a second act. And the biggest hurdle was trying to figure out how to make an act one finale, how to close an act one properly. And so that was certainly the biggest hurdle. And as far as liking it, I don't know. I was in two minds throughout the whole thing. I guess maybe I still am. I think when you're creating a show and you're working, you know, everyone must feel this, that there's things that you know that you love and there's things that you know that you feel just fail and you get away with it. You kind of live with that. The hurdle, how to close the first act properly, that was the toughest thing to figure out how to do.
That's one of the fun things I think about doing a two-act musical, is that it imposes, not for false reasons, but just for sheer, I think, storytelling reasons, certain obligations, rules, opportunities, hurdles, however you want to describe them, and that's how to end your first act and how to begin your second act and many other things as well. I think that's why I like them over one act. However, I can't tell you how many times I've said to writers working on projects, maybe this would work better as a one act. That usually happens early on before more work has been done and it's been proven to be long enough and sufficient for a full length. So, I have another question. You, sir?
When director and writers are working on a musical, in developing it prior to a commitment to a production, I hate to sort of drag this to the basement, but at what point, the writers own the words and the music, at what point does an agreement happen between, any kind of formal agreement between a director and writers? Is there a contract? What kind of things? I mean, essentially, the writers, you know, the Drama Guild contract says the writers own all those words and notes. So a director could be involved in a long development process and then suddenly, you know, they want a new director or a producer comes in and says we need so-and-so.
Actually, the Guild has a policy. You know, this has come up time. I'm on the Council of the Guild. And if the director starts from scratch with the writers and really contributes to the development of the musical, writers feel that the director is entitled to share in the future life of the project. It's been a sore point for a long time, but in fact, if the writer does contribute at that level, director rather, then of course it's there.
This is quite controversial, though. I mean, we shouldn't really get into it probably too deeply here. I will say one thing. You know, as a director, the authors can't actually give you the contractual right to direct their show. What they can say, and they can say it on paper if they want to, is we will do our best to have you be the director of our show, but it's actually the producer.
The producer or the theater options the piece and then hires everyone else with, obviously, with conversations with the writers and ultimately with the director as well.
It's awkward. It's a really good question. It's awkward because, like anything, the process is fluid. You know, and it's sometimes someone who has no impact at the beginning and just has a great impact throughout, and how does your, how does everyone reflect that? It's very, very tricky. And in the sense that directors aren't writers, yet they impact your writing. And so I guess that for every situation, it's a separate issue, but it's one that we constantly talk about in the teams. Of, are we doing well by each other? Does that affect the way that we work in the room because of that business angle? So it's such a good question.
This is kind of a communication question between the two. For an author, when you're being asked to cut five of the songs in your piece that you slaved over and adore, or totally rewrite the second act, it just doesn't work. What do you think it is that can come from the director in particular, but also a producer or anyone who might be giving you this advice? What do you think are the keys in helping you to understand that they get the core of your work, of what you're trying to do and say? And then for directors, what do you think you are able to do to communicate that? Because on both sides, I know I've found it, you know, very difficult to express to a playwright that I really do feel, you know, that I am married to
that I love the material, but when you ask for such huge changes, sometimes it's very hard for the author to feel that. And from the playwright side, I've felt it as well.
I've always felt that when I say absolutely not, I mean maybe. and that's because you're working with a director who obviously you've met or talked to, discussed the piece. You have to place a certain amount of trust in the room, and you have to place a certain amount of ego outside the door. And you have to be able to acknowledge, as Susan has mentioned, that the whole notion of making a musical is remaking a musical. And so everything really has to be up for grabs, and you have to go to your favorite, most wonderful moment, the If I Loved You scene from Carousel that you think you wrote, and go, is this serving my show? Is this serving what we're doing here? And be willing to ask the very, very hard questions to yourself. If you're going to ask them of your collaborators, you have to ask them of yourself as well. And so I found that at first, whenever, if something is particularly beloved and the director suggests moving it or cutting it or changing it in a drastic way, of course your initial reaction, at least mine, is like, you know, but you live with it over time, and I found that the wonderful directors I've worked with are also psychologists, and they're also parental, and they're also, in many ways, handholders, and they're very smart because they understand the notion of what a writer goes through and how difficult that can be, and I think always you find that place, because if you're really working on the same piece toward the same end, you'll find it together.
Sometimes the answer is just to do it, too. The thing I resisted most in Violet was there's a character that was not in the story that Susan felt should be in the story in the second act. And I just didn't want it there. I didn't think it needed to happen. I wrote the act without it. We did a reading that was never public, and I thought, oh, okay. You know, so sometimes you get to that point that if there's no further arguing that's possible, you know, and both sides has a point, even if it's just an informal, you know, you invite the five actors you know and sit around a dining room table, read the material and see if it works.
That's the key. I think it's hard to talk about cutting songs and cutting scenes and doing those sort of rewrites when you're sitting around the table essentially creating the piece. I mean, you do that. But you really talk about cutting songs and rewriting and adding scenes once you have the opportunity to see it, because it only truly exists. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. in front of an audience. And it's hard with the reading because you only get one shot, whereas in previews you have a longer period of time. But you have to be able to listen bravely to what the audience says, because they will bluntly tell you when they're bored. And they will also ecstatically tell you when they're happy. The trick is to be able to agree on what's causing that excitement and what that boredom is.
The only danger with that is that something that Susan reminds us of, is a reading is almost always an audition. So this particular passage of the play preceded a reading that we did, and we cut the entire passage because we knew two-thirds of it was not successful. So we had the experience of testing it out with actors, but we weren't going to let New York see.
Yeah, right. Readings are tougher for this than actual previews. And you obviously want as many previews as you can so that you can rewrite the show if you need to. Yes?
Did any of you have any collaborations that you felt did not work out? And then how did you handle it beyond the things you talked about, psychology, compromise, etc.?
You mean between writers and directors,
yes,
specifically? Right. If everybody has one of those stories, you're welcome to tell it, but you must not mention any names or give any clues away, because I'll have to work with these people.
Yeah. I have a piece in San Francisco, David Gordon, who is, I don't know if you know, the downtown director.
They can't hear you.
Oh, my God, I'll yell. I don't want to worry about that. Oh, my God. David Gordon is a downtown director, fantastic choreographer, works with Philip Glass all the time, wonderful. And we did something in San Francisco and L.A. called first picture show, and it just was crap. It just did not work, you know. And I think because the collaboration was not, it's what Frank Lesser used to call, everybody wasn't at the same level, and I don't mean the level of quality, I mean the level of, we were baking the same cake. We were. I was making a pie, and he was making a carburetor, and it was a mess. But it was because we weren't really communicating about what the hell were we doing. And you know, and I've seen his pieces before that and after that, and they're fantastic. And it was just one of those things that we hadn't made those core decisions, those, you know, what Michael Mayer calls the critical decisions of what exactly do you want to see? Exactly what do you want to see? And that's why I think musicals are so difficult, because it's a committee. It's inherently a committee headed by, you know, a woman or a man who's at the helm of a huge tanker. And then that was, I watched it go from something that was actually core and avant-garde piece, and when we came aboard, like, I did not want to do with it so much. I wanted more music and more song form, and I kept thinking, this doesn't feel right, you know, that little voice in your head, what I should have really done, and I'll use it for the rest of time, is I'm not going to do it, it's going to bring it down. And I just thought, maybe I'm wrong, but I was right, because it was the piece that I was looking at that was sending it really all ways. We went to San Francisco and it was wrong. We went to LA and it was wronger. It was just not getting worse and worse and worse. And we're all still friends and all that, but the collaboration just was all this way. You know, and we had a dramaturg working with us, and she had a different thought about what we were doing. It was just one of those things that completely didn't work. But I learned so much from that. I kind of thank God for that experience, because it's a visceral reaction now when I sense there's something that's being said. You know, the voice is going, abort! So it teaches, you know, that when you're not on the same thing, there's almost a panic button that sets in.
And you can tell that early now?
You know, when we were in La Jolla with Early Modern Millie, which Susan saw, I mean, that show out there was just not good. The second act was fine, and the first act was not good. And Dick Scanlon, who was a great writer and a great friend, we basically, everyone got great reviews and all of this stuff, and we looked at each other and thought, wait, this is crap. You know, the first act just isn't good, and that panic set in when you know that it's what you're experiencing, and you trust it, and so we went away and rewrote the whole thing. And so I like it. It was really because of that first experience, that visceral, the ding 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 dings, which I didn't have when I was younger because I was too scared to find the voice to say, I don't agree. It's like, what? Into the mic. I have that now.
I have a question about that. It did do well in La Jolla. Were the audiences telling you they were really liking that first act, but
yes,
you sensed that there was something wrong?
You know, it's funny, because I was, Susan saw it, I kept saying, this is awful, isn't it? And she kept saying,
Now, it's really not awful. Gives up death. I saw that performance. You know, Variety gave it this fantastic, not for me, it's really not my show, it's much more about Dick and Rob Ashford and Michael Mayer. It's, I saw the performance that the Variety guy saw, and it was like a Mazda. It was, I mean, not one laugh, not one. I couldn't believe it, and Dick and I went, and we threw back 7 apple martinis. And this review comes out, and I thought, that is not the show that we experienced, that the audience has experienced. It's just, no one, little, there was not one laugh in the first act, right? Yes.
And the truth will set you free, ladies.
I tried. And see, I have the other option because I want to cut everything. I'm way too brutal, and that's why Brian, I think, we leveled each other out really beautifully on Pilot because he and Susan was a good moderator. Brian was very steady and calm, and I'm just like wild-eyed Sicilian. Cut it! It sucks! And they were, you know, on the level of just let it be, you know, just let it be, let it live in front of a paying audience. Reading audiences don't tell you, I've done anything except,
yeah,
right, they're fake. They're loving and fake. And fake in a sense, like it's, you know.
But sometimes out of town, depending on the city, you know, you can have a wild reception in some city. Trying to love the toast of Baltimore.
Yes, I saw it.
Get
that's
a ticket.
Right.
It was like, you know, and some reporter in New York went, this is the next threat. Well, of course it got to New York, and the New York Times hated it. But really hated it. And you just can't know.
I guess the question really that I always ask about the teams that I'm working on is, what do you think? When you were in Baltimore, did you believe in it? Like, when I was in La Jolla, I thought,
no.
Crap. And then, is now the show good or bad?
I think
that we saw.
Yeah, I think Janine is making an extremely important point, which is you really need to go with your instincts. You can sit there and an audience could be going crazy, and if you don't feel it's good, you don't feel it's right, you feel something's missing, you're right as the creator. You know in your heart, and you must follow those instincts. I think the success of Millie is based on the fact that the creators did not believe what they read in the newspaper. They said, wait a minute, we can do better than this. This has to be improved. We need to work on that. And they did, because they really, they listened to their inner voices. I mean, they had lots of people telling them, it's great, it's terrific, don't touch it, it's wonderful, you know, da, 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 da. And they really insisted on doing work. And I think as creators, you need to stay there. You need to really go with your feelings on something like that.
I think that's really important when they're negative. It's tricky when sometimes, you know, especially from a reading, as you alluded to, audiences' reactions to readings can sometimes be extremely favorable because you're friends and so on in the audience. And I've had the experience with writers who point to that reaction as to the measure of success or of completion of a certain work. And that can be kind of tricky when the feeling you come away with, because you want it to be good, obviously, you're opening yourself up as an author or director in front of an audience, and you certainly want to be accepted, and it's completely understandable. But it is a challenge to sometimes for directors or for writers to eat as well, to look at that positive reaction clinically and say, really, where though was that response coming from? And did they really connect with this journey, et cetera, et cetera? And those are, when you have a positive feeling, you have to really also analyze it to make sure it's not just out of enthusiasm or wishful thinking.
Right.
And that's tricky to do. And tricky as a director to sort of ask an author.
It really makes the difference, don't you think? I mean, it really is the difference in being able to go with that critical self, that little beat that goes, you know what, that section is not working. I feel it went fine, and everybody, you know, liked it, but I feel it. It's not working. Something's wrong. It's corrupt. It's not true. It's not honest. It's not getting there.
I wonder if, I'm sorry to interrupt, if Bobby can, I hope you don't mind, but I really want to know, I've heard that for Paper Mill, that you've been asked to do Sour Jones song, which is coming in this season, a great word of mouth about it, but I've heard that the folklore is that Paper Mill had asked you to do it, and you examined it and realized that there was a whole other musical happening in there, so it seems to talk to as a directive. Now, you're working with Richard Rodgers, and you've totally revamped that show, haven't you? So, I mean, that's a different kind of relationship, you know, in a sense. You really, it's almost like a new musical.
Well, in a way it is. There's not a word of the original book in the show. David Henry Wong wanted to do this show and had a long passion about it, whether it was filled with stereotypes that initially his generation riled against and said, this is not us, this is not accurately portraying us, while secretly sort of loving it. In fact, they could see this fabulous movie, Technicolor movie, filled with Asian American people singing and dancing and being glamorous, and a beautiful score. And I have never, you know, there are so many revivals right now happening, many of them terrific work, but this one spoke to me, and it's another sideshow analogy of people to the left of life who carve out place for themselves, and I suggested to David, let's put a show business frame on this, and bringing with his family background of them Butterfly and Golden Child, it's been a very interesting journey we've had. We made a new show. We took this score and removed characters and completely threw it up in the air. So it's a radical experiment that played very well in Los Angeles, but I've had these films that we're talking about. The Montaigne Reform is not used to having big musical comedy, so these people went crazy for this. And I would still go, that's not it, though. I know I can do better, but it stopped the show, Bobby. Well, it didn't stop it for me. I gotta, you know, I know I can make it better. So we're still not settling on the success of that, and a lot of rewrites are taking place before we come in.
You know, I think we probably have time for one more question, and I've seen this hand back here for quite a while. I don't mean to cut things off, but I believe there are other things that need to happen during the day, so we'll take this question. And
it's a follow-up on the subject of following your instinct. Has anyone ever had the reverse experience, namely that your instincts tell you you're right on, and the audiences, for whatever reason, are just not responding? And if that's the case, what then do you do?
I think you have to, to a certain extent, you've got to follow your audience a little bit. I mean, you don't want to sort of go to the lowest common denominator all the time. But you can't tell it from one performance. That's the big trick. And that's the problem with readings. Or even two performances. You know, I've had that experience where, like, for some reason, at my first previews, I always get more laughs than I ever get for the rest of the entire run of the show. And I always wonder why that is. But there are things that will work at one performance which won't work other times. And you kind of have to sit back, I think. I mean, I don't know if others agree with me. And sort of look at it over a course of a little bit of time and say, okay, that did seem to work. And even though I really love that, nobody else does because they're doing this at the end of the number. And you do, to a certain extent, have to listen to your audience, I think.
I also am a fan of asking pointed questions to people, not only people I know, but people I don't know. Oftentimes when you're developing a show, you get to do talkbacks where the creators will come out and talk to the audience. And I'm always interested if there's a segment of the show that we've all been talking about that we weren't sure about or that seemed to play okay tonight or whatever, but I like to ask the audience, did anybody here remember that part where he had the knife in his hand and, you know, whatever, and ask people if they felt what they felt about that section? Because then you hear specifically from people what their reactions are. Even people with an unschooled way of speaking about a musical, like my mother, who can give you incredible insights because they just tell you what they felt when they saw it. And you go, you know, there's something to that.
And I was in a cafe right after that workshop of the Wild Party, and talk about brave. He came right over. I was sitting with my friend Tina, and he said, okay, body bag, in or out? Latte.
Wow,
but it was very, like, it's true,
because
he really did, like, I
want to
know, exactly.
Well, I have to say also, from Janine, I did a show together where we were the music staff on a Condon and Green show, and
Janine, about talking about changing things and working in the show, she has this great phrase that I have adopted, which is, I know I'm going to have an unpopular point of view here. And then you say the thing. And I learned it from her because it's really true, because you have to have the bravery, I think. It takes a certain amount of courage to say to your collaborators,
I think, ladies and gentlemen, we will leave on that point. Bob, thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Masters of the Stage. This program was made possible by support from Stage Directors and Choreographers Society, the National Labor Union, celebrating 5 decades representing the needs and aspirations of its members.